Chief Judge and Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Moorfield. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is I represent the opponent, Sergeant Drew Moorfield.
Could you move the microphone and speak a little more directly into it? Thanks.
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
May do so. Please proceed.
Yes, you're going to need to move that microphone a little closer still.
Yeah. Is that better, Your Honor?
Yeah. Thank you.
At its core, this case is about attorneys identifying and disclosing conflicts of interest, and while that's essential to the integrity and the appearance of fairness of the military justice system. In this case, Staff Judge Advocate did not disclose such a conflict, causing a disqualified SJA to advise a convening authority, seriously compromising the processing of appellant's court-martial. Turning to the issue in this case, it's whether the Staff Judge Advocate should have recused himself pursuant to JAG Instruction 5803.1, Bravo, Rule 1.12, and whether his failure to do so prejudiced the appellant. Rule 1.12 requires that an attorney shall not represent a party in connection with a matter in which he had served personally and substantially as a judge unless there is full disclosure and consent from the parties.
All right, how is this the same matter? That you're talking about two courts, one special, one general, 5 years apart.
That's right, Your Honor. Courts applying these rules of disqualification or these rules of professional conduct to trials generally apply a variation of what's known as a substantial relationship test. Basically, it's a test that is applied on a case-by-case basis to analyze the relationship between the matters and the involvement of the attorney. Courts applying these rules have applied them to situations involving two different trials. To give an example of such a situation, the Ninth Circuit, in the case of In Re County of Los Angeles, found that an attorney could not represent a plaintiff in a case against the County of Los Angeles and a deputy sheriff, where he presided as a judge in another case against the same two parties, LA County and the sheriff, from a separate but similar incident several years earlier. There were two different incidents of police misconduct in two different trials, two different plaintiffs. The attorney served as a judge in the first trial against the county and the sheriff. A few years later, there was a different incident. And there, his firm was going to represent the plaintiff in that matter. The court found, even though the only relationship was in the defendants and the same sheriff in a similar incident, that was enough. That was a potential relationship.
Okay, two questions. Number one, don't these cases tie substantially factually related to disclosure of confidential information?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And Poly Software holds that judges usually don't get that kind of confidential information. Is there anything on the record here that would indicate that this judge sitting as judge in the first court 5 years earlier got any sort of confidential information that would have in any way affected his performance as SJA in the second case?
No, Your Honor. The appellant does not allege or is not trying to state that there's any actual evidence that the judge in this case got confidential information.
Well, then how are they substantially related?
The reason they're substantially related in this situation is it's true. The civilian courts applying the substantial relationship test, they're all driven by the fact that a judge may get confidential information. Generally, that could be through an ex parte hearing or some other effect. While it is, in theory, a judge may come across confidential information to court martial, that is not the main issue in this case. The main issue in this case is the information that the judge obtained at the first court martial that could affect his opinions and develop biases against the appellant.
Is there anything on the record about that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Answer Judge Ryan's question.
I'm sorry,
what specific evidence are you alleging that he learned in the first trial that would impact his advice to the convening authority in the second trial? With specificity that's in the record.
Your Honor, the prejudice is mainly based on the potential of bias developing and the appearance of impropriety that could result. Because there was no disclosure, there was never a motion going, we don't have a factual record to determine what exactly he may have learned. We don't have a record trial from the first court-martial to review to find out what came out. What we know about the first court-martial is that there were eight counts. It was a contested trial. There were eight counts of eight.
So just to stop you for a second, so is your answer that there's nothing in the record with specificity that tells us information that the judge had in the first trial that he then used as a staff judge advocate in this trial?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no direct evidence of an actual bias or an actual impropriety.
Thank you.
The record, Judge Stuck, you had a question.
Well, I was simply going to say that particular matter is a term of art when used in things like the joint ethics regulation and is generally used to refer to a discrete legal controversy. That's not the case here. How do you get around that?
I mean, appellant's answer would be the reason this case is different and this case is stronger than the civilian cases applying substantial relationship.
Well, I'm not talking about civilian cases. I'm talking about the JER. But go ahead.
Okay. It's based on the fact of the unique role that the SJA plays. Where in the civilian sector, you're worried about the confidential information the judge may acquire and then use to the disadvantage of the accused. The SJA, while he is representing the convening authority and the government, he's also required to be a neutral and impartial advocate or impartial advisor to the convening authority. So the risk is not that he just will get confidential information that he could use against the accused. It's that he might obtain information that will develop a bias. If he develops a bias from that first trial, that could theoretically cause him to be disqualified as an SJA because he would no longer be impartial and could no longer serve the function of an impartial SJA for advising the convening authority pre-trial and post-trial.
But in response to Judge Ryan, you said there is no such evidence of record of any bias.
That's correct, Your Honor. This is based on an appearance of impropriety.
Okay, so this is an appearance case. You're not arguing either the statute or the reg?
Well, the appearance, appearance of impropriety is recognized in cases dealing with conflicts of interest. There, generally, you either show, there's a confidential information test where you actually show confidences that were disclosed, and then you've got the substantial relationship, and that the attorney was in a situation that he could have obtained, that the relationship was so close that you presume he received that kind of information that could detriment the accused later on. It's the appearance that a reasonable member of the public, knowing the role he played and the role he's playing in the later matter, could come against and would, you know, adversely affect the accused.
Now, the accused was acquitted in the first court-martial, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, the risk that we have here is that in the second court-martial, we have 18 different counts of assault that are brought. In the first court-martial, you have eight counts of assault, a kidnapping charge, and a rape charge. Even though it was a member's trial, but as a human being, undoubtedly the judge would come to his own conclusion about the weight of the evidence and whether the accused was guilty or innocent or whatnot. We don't, even though he was acquitted, we don't know what kind of opinions or biases that the military judge had. A reasonable person would assume that judge would come to some kind of opinion about the accused. And then we can fast forward a few years where we have a new court-martial involving similar charges. The charges from the first court-martial involve accusations from the girlfriend from assault. The second court-martial were more accusations from different girlfriends. So it's reasonable to make an assumption or to come to a conclusion that the staff judge advocate could view the appellant as a serial girlfriend beater or something to that effect. And he may feel that he got away with something in the first court-martial, and now that he has him in the second court-martial, he could have that bias, and he's going to go out, I mean, he's going to make sure that he's not going to get a good deal, and he's going to advise the convening authority to go forward with all the charges and not provide impartial advice.
Counsel, at the in terms of the situation we face, we're dealing with an SJA who's advising a convening authority with respect to the convening authority's pretrial functions. Is that the precise point at which we're focused?
There are two areas of prejudice, Your Honor. There's pretrial for the pretrial Article 34 advice, and also his advising the convening authority for pretrial negotiations. And then you've got potential prejudice post-trial regarding the SJR and clemency. So you have two potential areas of prejudice where a biased impartial SJA would not be able to fulfill the statutory role of an impartial SJA in those two areas.
Okay, let's focus on pretrial first. In the pretrial, the convening authority provides both a prosecutorial function, that is determining whether a case will be referred to trial, and a judicial function, selecting the panel members. Now, with respect to the judicial function, What in this case would have precluded an individual who served as the judge in the first trial from serving as a judge in the second trial?
Well, it's true that the Article 34 advice has been recognized to be a prosecutorial function for both the convening authority and the statutory advocate. It's also been recognized that the person providing the Article 34 advice needs to be a neutral and impartial SJA.
Well, judges need to be neutral and impartial too, don't they?
That's true, Your Honor.
So my question is, what would in this case have precluded the military judge in the first case from serving as a military judge in the second case?
It would be the appearance of impropriety, or the appearance that he developed a bias against the accused. If he has a bias against the accused, he's no longer impartial.
Is there any case that stands for a proposition that an individual who serves as a judge in case one in a situation such as we face here cannot serve as a judge in case two?
The appellant is not aware of any military case involving a military judge then becoming an SJA. A case that addresses...
I'm just asking about military judge. What case would preclude... We were talking first about the judicial function that the convening authority performs and the SJA advises the convening authority on. What case would stand for the proposition that a judge who served in the circumstances here could not serve as a judge in the second case? In other words, could Colonel Coleman have served in the judge in the case that's
not? The question, what case would stand for a military judge not being able to provide the Article 34 advice?
No. My question is, serving as a judge, the functions of the convening authority are both judicial and prosecutorial, so I'm trying to break it down. With respect to the judicial function that the convening authority provides, he's serving in the capacity as a judge at that point. What case would stand for the proposition that Colonel Coleman, having served as a judge in the first case, could not serve as a judge in the second case?
Oh, the second case.
Right, the case now before us. Is there any case that would have precluded?
No, okay. No, Your Honor.
So if he could serve as a judge, why can't he serve as an advisor to the convening authority with respect to the convening authority's judicial functions?
The distinction appellant would make there is that as the judge, as the SJA is unique, the military judge isn't tasked with giving advice to the convening authority. A staff judge advocate is tasked with giving advice to the convening authority.
But he's giving advice to, would he be precluded as serving as a law clerk to a judge?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, would he be precluded from serving as a prosecutor in the second case? Served as a judge in the first case, can he serve as a prosecutor in the second case?
Under appellant's theory that the disqualification is based on his impartiality to not serve as a neutral SJA, no, unless there was evidence that he had confidential information. If he had confidential information from the first trial, then no, he would not be able to serve as a prosecutor in the second trial.
And there's no evidence in this case as to confidential information?
No, there's no direct evidence.
Okay, so if he could serve as a judge and if he could serve as a prosecutor, why can't he serve as an advisor to the person who performs both functions?
As far as the judge, but the distinction the opponent would make there is that the judge is not in the role of advising or influencing the convening authority. The judge would have no control over the convening authority, how he's acting pre-trial.
Could he serve as a convening authority?
If there was evidence that he was, a convening authority, as yesterday, needs to be impartial or to not be.
In this case, would Colonel Coleman have been disqualified from serving as the convening authority?
Potentially, Your Honor.
Potentially, how about in this case right now?
I mean, in this case, the military judge is not per se disqualified. There is, because of the potential for impropriety or the appearance, it triggers the rule that there needs to be disclosure, at which point you can analyze the relationship of the two matters and his involvement. At the very least, the Rule 1.12 would apply to a situation where he's becoming a convening authority, where he would need to disclose such a fact.
So you have a failure of disclosure. Let's assume that's the case. Where's the prejudice?
The prejudice lies in the appearance of impropriety. It's a similar test to implied bias, where you have a member's challenge, where a reasonable member of the public would doubt the fairness of the proceeding. The role of a neutral SJA is well established in case law.
If a member of a panel does not disclose a particular fact, and that fact is not per se disqualifying, is that prejudicial? Does that create an appearance of bias?
If the fact that was not disclosed could create an appearance of implied bias, is that?
No. If a member doesn't disclose a fact, and we determine on appeal that that fact itself would not disqualify the member, and that there's nothing in the record that would establish disqualification, how does that establish an appearance of lack of impartiality?
In a situation where a fact that the member did not disclose, if it would not create any appearance issue, then no, that would not be disqualified.
Okay. Well, where in this case is the prejudice in terms of creating an appearance of impartiality? There's no, according to you, there's no evidence of any confidential information disclosed to the judge in the first case. So where do we find the prejudice in his failure to disclose?
Again, appellant acknowledges that there is no actual bias or no actual evidence that any confidential information was, given to the military judge.
Well, counsel, what are we to make of the fact that the rules for court-martial specifically set forth when a staff judge advocate is going to be disqualified in giving advice to a convening authority, and there's no there's nothing made of the fact that they acted as a military judge in a former case, and there's no discussion about appearances of impropriety. There's a specific rule and a discussion that talks about other examples.
Just to briefly comment on Article 6 and Rule for Court Martial 1106, those have been applied broadly to situations that go outside the direct applications for there have been situations where a staff judge advocate has not served in a different capacity, but nevertheless, he was found to be impartial and not be able to give neutral and impartial advice.
But that was when he was actually not going to be able to give neutral and impartial and advice, not a case like this one where you're suggesting that there's just an appearance issue without any specific facts.
I mean, that's why the appellant doesn't rely on disqualification. There's no per se disqualification. Article 6 would be disqualification without an opportunity for disclosure and consent.
But it sounds to me like what you're arguing for is, by another name, a per se disqualification, but per se based on an appearance of impropriety, whether there's anything to support that or not.
I've probably come off unclear, but to clarify, the appellant is not looking for per se disqualification. Appellant is arguing the main point is there needs to be disclosure. SJ was not per se disqualified by his former role.
But you're not suggesting that the information wasn't available to the defense in this case, right?
No, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time.
You'll have an opportunity to rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Colonel Lou Puglio, and I represent the United States. Despite Colonel Coleman's prior involvement in appellant September 1999 special court-martial as a military judge, Colonel Coleman was not prohibited or otherwise disqualified as acting as the SJA in the appellant's second court-martial in December 4th. Because the court-martials involved different matters, that is, different facts and different circumstances. Rule 1.12 requires disqualification only if the SJA and the judge acted in the same matter, that is, those cases involving same facts, same circumstances. Nor was he disqualified under Rule of Court Martial 1106B or Article 6C, since the first court martial was simply not the same case as the second court martial, and the accused and the appellant has made no colorable claim of possible prejudice. What the appellant confuses here is the terms found in Rule 1.9, that is, substantially related matters, with the definition of the matter under Rule 1.12. They are two different standards. As one of the judges pointed out in Poly Software International, the federal courts recognize this difference. Under Rule 1.12, a matter is deemed to be the same when it has a discrete and isolatable incidents involving the same transaction. That is, the same facts, the same circumstances, the same parties, the same conditions. This is much narrower than the standards set out in 1.9, that is, substantially related matters, which is designed to protect the confidences of attorneys. A matter under 1.12 is only similar if they involve the same facts and circumstances. Under the ABA's formal rule 97-409, the ABA addresses these concerns. They define matter under 1.12 the same as they define matter under Rule 1.11. And they say that Rule 1.11 and 1.12 is intended to codify the discussion limiting the term a matter to the same matter. That formal opinion goes on to state that the term contemplates a discrete and isolatable transaction or set of transactions between identifiable parties. That is, the same lawsuit or litigation is the same matter. The same issue of fact involving the same parties and the same situation or conduct is the same matter. And the courts have generally looked to see whether two or more arguably related matters involve the same parties or the same facts. This is set forth in Poly Software International, where they say that the term a matter, as described in 1.11, is the same as a matter described in 1.12. That court found that disqualification under 1.12 is applicable only when you have factually discrete and isolatable transactions. That is, do the two events involve the same parties, the same situation, and the same conduct? Here, there are two separate court motions, and they are not part of a discrete or isolated transaction.
Counsel, there are situations in which a judge, including a military judge, will be exposed to information to which a prosecution is not exposed. One example might be a grant of immunity in which there's a question as to whether a wall was set up within a prosecutorial office, isolating one group of prosecutors from another so that the immunized testimony would not be used against an individual. Another might be an ex parte filing from defense in a particular matter related to discovery or privilege. If a judge in trial one is exposed to that information, can that judge serve as a prosecutor in trial two against the same individual?
Under those factors, no.
So that then goes to my question of, under what circumstances does a person who has served as a judge in trial one need to disclose, putting aside the issue of prejudice? Let's assume there's no prejudice in this case. We're only talking about the issue of disclosure. Under what circumstances does the judge need to disclose on the record the participation in trial one when that judge is then serving in a second case, let's say first as prosecutor?
Under those circumstances, if there's any standard under either our conflict of interest laws or the DON or DOD conflict of interest rules, that would be a requirement that he disclose. So you'd have to go to the rules to determine when he's required to disclose whatever the conflict is.
And so in this case, is there a requirement to disclose in the sense that the responsibility then for determining whether there was or was not a conflict can't be assessed until the disclosure has been made?
Under these circumstances, no, sir, because there was no conflict of interest involved. the first case, as we know, that Colonel Coleman acted as a military judge. It was a member's trial. He received information that was otherwise unprivileged, as far as we know, and then acted later, 5 years later, as an SJA.
But as you point out, as far as we know, here we would be making the prosecutor the sole judge of the issue of prejudice, as opposed to the issue of disclosure. Why shouldn't the person who's acting as a prosecutor in case two be required to disclose that they were previously a judge in a prior case? That doesn't constitute a disqualification of the prosecutor in the second case. That then provides information upon which the defense can determine whether there's a motion to be made to disqualify.
I think that the rules place the burden upon the attorney himself to know his ethical responsibilities and disclose them. So it's not theoretical in the sense that if there's a universal connection with a prior case that requires disclosure later. An attorney is presumed to know his ethical responsibilities, and if there's a potential that those ethical responsibilities are put in jeopardy by the conflict of interest rule, he or she has the duty to come forward. So the burden is upon the person who may have that conflict to come forward. They are presumed to know the rules regarding conflict within our own.
And is the same then true with respect to a judge who's sitting on case two, that the judge is not required to disclose that they previously sat? And what I'm thinking of is here, say, on one hand, it would seem obvious if the defendant's sitting at the table, they'll say, hey, that's the same judge who sat in my first trial. But a defendant, an untutored in the law individual, may not realize that that's a problem. Only the lawyer would know that that's a problem. So why shouldn't the judge be required to disclose that to the parties and let the parties then determine whether there's a motion to be made?
Well, I think under those circumstances there is a problem. If the judge sat on the accused or a co-accused court martial the first time and now is facing the accused again in a second court martial, there is the potential, and you'd want to disclose that, assuming that they recognized each other and assuming that, oh yes, that was he was before me before. So in those circumstances, I think it would be proper for the judge, because to disclose that fact, to allow the parties to decide whether they want to challenge the judge under 902 or some other conflict.
And why don't we have that here, where the convening authority is acting in a judicial capacity and the SJA is advising the convening authority in the convening authority's judicial capacity?
I believe because, one, it wasn't until somewhere just before the court martial that Colonel Coleman realized that I sat as a judge in this case, and two, there didn't seem to be a conflict. There didn't seem to be a violation or a potential violation of the JAG instructions and our conflict of interest rule, which would require the SJA, Colonel Coleman in this case, to disclose that. There just was no conflict. I think that's the answer.
I understand your answer.
There was no actual potential.
Now, I think you just alluded to this. Is there anything on the record that shows when the SJA became aware that he had sat on the first case?
I do. There's a affidavit by Colonel Coleman. I believe it's in Joint Appendix 53. Okay. And he says sometimes prior. He doesn't remember if it was before or after his Article 34 advice letter, but it was sometimes prior to the court martial. Okay. But as Judge Ryan pointed out, the defense had this information. If the court would go to Appellate Exhibit 7, which is the defense's motion in limine filed with the court below, the record of trial or the results of trial of the first trial is attached as an exhibit to the defense's motion in limine on page 19 of that exhibit. Also, in the Article 32, the results of the first trial are attached to the Article 32 report. And in both of those situations, Colonel Coleman, although a lieutenant colonel at the time, is identified as the military judge. So the defense was on notice that Colonel Coleman had acted as the judge in the prior court. The appellant confuses the standards under 1.9 and the standards under 1.12. And as the government previously stated, the standards under 1.12 are narrower than those under 1.9. 1.9 deals with client confidences. It prohibits an attorney from representing someone else in a matter or in a matter or a similarly situated matter that would divulge client confidences. And if we look to Poly Software, as Judge Stupi pointed out, the court makes a distinction between 1.9 and 1.2. And it says with regard to 1.9, substantially related factual matters are defined more broadly and encompass not only the same matter, but also encompass a matter where there's a substantial or a substantive factual thread that runs through both matters. That's not the case under 1.12. A matter is the same matter. In these two court martials, we have different victims. We have different locations for each of the crimes. We have different convening authorities. We have different forms. We have different crimes encompassing different periods of time, different investigating officers, and it's all separated by 5 years. The bottom line is the appellant has made no culpable claim of prejudice, even if there was a disqualification in this case, either under 1106B or Article 6C, the staff judge advocate was not disqualified. However, if there is some disqualification that this court finds, we'd move on to the second matter, whether there was prejudice. This court has stated previously in United States versus Finster that the appellant has to show some colorable claim of prejudice. There simply is none here. Colonel Coleman recognized that he, or in his affidavit states, that he signed the SJR on 7 July 2005 and thereafter transferred on 8 July 2005. Because of some mix-up over the service of the SJR, a new SJR was done by Colonel Marchiero, who had no connection with this case. It was Colonel Marchiero's letter that went up to the convening authority, and the convening authority assumingly relied on Colonel Marchiero's letter to determine his action. So there's no culpable claim of prejudice either pre-trial or during the post-trial process. Under those grounds, this court should deny the appellant's claim of prejudice. If there are no further questions, that completes the government's argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Because these two cases had the same accused and there's a similar nature between the charges, there is a common thread to these two court martials. An attorney has an ethical duty to identify and disclose potential conflicts of interest. Because there is a potential of him developing a bias against the accused, would make him impartial and disqualify him as a staff judge advocate, there could be an appearance of impropriety. If there could be an appearance of impropriety, that would trigger Rule 1.12. The key is disclosure. The purpose of the rule is to disclose the conflict of interest, to give the accused a chance to challenge him and to develop.
Well, here he didn't disclose. So what is there? Have you looked at the record? I'm not asking for testimony here, but what is there in the record of the first trial that would identify a conflict of interest?
We do not have the record of trial from the first trial. It was a full acquittal, which means there's a question that a record was ever produced for the
That's a public record. Does it exist or not?
The appellant, if it does exist, the appellant has never been
received. Okay, thank you.
Again, disclosure is the key. The purpose of disclosure is to put the appellant on notice that there's a potential conflict there and would give him the opportunity to bring a motion to disqualify. The appellant never had a chance to bring that motion. Thus, we don't have a factual record, making it extremely difficult to attempt to assess prejudice. because there's no factual record, there are doubts about the level of knowledge he had or the potential that he could have developed the bias. As stated by the Supreme Court of Indiana,
did anything happen in the proceedings in this case, either below at this court, that precluded you from submitting affidavits that would establish the necessary factual record?
The appellant submitted an affidavit to the lower court, the Indiana Supreme Court, in which he made allegations that information from the first trial was used again at the second trial. I was not the appellate counsel for the initial briefs in this, but from my understanding is they attempted to submit new affidavits which were rejected by this court. So to answer your question, there may have been an opportunity, but that was not done here.
Is there anything in those affidavits that would establish the prejudice that you're now claiming?
No, the affidavits would merely establish the potential for prejudice.
Thank you.
The appellant is in complete agreement. This is not based on confidential information that may have created an actual conflict. It's based on the appearance of impropriety, in that a military judge then serving as an SJA could potentially develop a bias against the accused, and if he's biased, he would be impartial. An impartial SJA cannot advise a convening authority for pretrial or for post-trial. It's very clear that for post-trial, for a defective SJR, if you have a disqualified SJA, you need a mere colorable showing of prejudice. The potential of prejudice has been recognized as that colorable showing, because these actions are inherently discretionary, and it's extremely difficult to pinpoint prejudice in inherently discretionary acts. Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time.
If you'd like to briefly conclude, you may do so.
Your Honor, as noted by the Supreme Court of Indiana, sometimes an attorney, guiltless in any actual sense, nevertheless is required to stand aside for the sake of public confidence and the probity of the administration of justice. That principle is applicable here because this SJA potentially had a bias against the accused, which would disqualify him from giving neutral advice to the convening authority. Because it's extremely difficult to assess prejudice in a discretionary act, the only way to level the playing field is to put them back in the position they would have been in had there not been an error and had there not been a disqualified SJA. Thus, the only way to cure this error is to put them back in the original position, which is why the appellant asks this court to set aside the findings and sentence in order here.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:45 a.m.
Court stands in recess until 9:45.